science is conspiracy paranoia.
The issue isn't whether you're paranoid, Lenny. The issue is whether you're paranoid enough.
Catapults of propaganda.
Alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert. Sharon is off this week, actually, at a family reunion in Indiana. She's back home in, as the song goes, back home again in Indiana, her hometown of Madison. If you've read her novel, either one of the novels, actually, Winds of Evil or the follow-up to it, Signs and Wonders, the focus of those novels, Eden, Indiana, is actually based on Madison. So you have an idea of where she's spending her week this week. But so that you won't need to listen to me blather for a full hour today, we've got a special guest, a gentleman who's become a semi-regular on the Glenn Beck syndicated radio program. He's also been a regular on the Dave Glover Show on 97.1 FM, a talk radio station in St. Louis, as co-host of a feature called Paranormal Tuesday, show I listened to for many years while I was out of the radio business. My producer, Justin, is thrilled every time he's on our show here in Columbia because he's a big fan of Dr. Michael Lynch. Michael, thanks for taking time out to join us on PID Radio today.
Oh, thank you, Doug, for inviting me. I appreciate any time we get to talk because, like I said, you know, like minds can really do wonders once they get together. And many times in many facets, they don't get together and they don't stay together. But we have to now. We're like-minded people need to stay together and swap information and get information to the public in any way now as possible. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of legislature coming up about the internet being sequestered, you might say, to a certain extent. And as well, I have seen no legislation on satellite radio being sequestered by any. So you can see where there's money, there is no problem. When there's no money, then there's, you know, we'll put in some jurisdiction there. And,
the parts of the internet that they want to regulate are the parts where the recording industry thinks it's losing money regarding online streaming. But that's another story.
Yeah.
Michael is a paranormal investigator. He's also, like us, a guy who looks for answers beyond the original or beyond the official story. And we talked for about 90 minutes less time for commercials, news, traffic, weather, and business on Friday on the Eagle 93.9 in Columbia. But there's only so much you can do when you're interrupted every 7 minutes for another commercial message. Here we'll go for a full, you know, hour, give or take, and no stops, just kind of stream of consciousness. Kind of want to focus on, as we talked Friday, Michael, on the North American Union as sort of a first step toward a global government.
Yeah.
As you know, as we've talked before, we approach this the issues of the world, political, physical, spiritual, from a Christian perspective.
Absolutely.
And many of our listeners are Christian as well. And of course, the idea, the prophecy of a one world government is key in end times prophecy. So when we see baby steps being taken along the lines of a North American Union, mirroring what happened over in Europe over the last 50 years, of course, gets our attention. You were a guest on the Glenn Beck program about a week and a half ago, we're explaining to Glenn some of the things that are coming about in terms of the North American Union, the North American Super Corridor, NAFTA Superhighway, and the replacing of the dollar with the Amero. And not sure that Glenn is totally on board with this yet. He's partly there, but it's a lot to swallow all at once, I guess. What is it you see out there that leads you to believe that the dollar is on its way out, and how does that factor into the integration of the U.S. with its neighbors?
Well, the main crux of this whole thing is that on the news, I just saw it again this morning, where our dollar has equaled or reduced below the equivalent of the Canadian dollar.
Right.
Now, if you want a one world or one trade zone currency, such as Europe has now with the euro, you have to equalize or devise a basic secondary monetary value of all of your currencies. So if you have a very strong currency and you're wanting to negotiate trade, tariffs, port restrictions, things like this, then it is best that all the dollars are equalized by trade. So the Canadian dollar is equal to the American dollar, which is equal to or close to that of the Mexican peso, you see. Now, in Saudi Arabia, they back their currency by the petrochemical dollar, the price of oil. So that's like a whole different standard altogether. There's the gold standard, there's the silver standard, and so these standards are common throughout the globe. They virtually run the entire globe. But let's say you have a strong currency like the dollar has been for the past, 35 years. Other countries heavily bought physical dollars, purchased physical dollars to line their banks, their vaults with, in order to shore up their currency, which again is based upon its printing value. Okay.
Well, that, but also the fact that you can only exchange dollars for oil on the London and New York exchanges, which is the two principal petroleum exchanges in the world. You cannot use euros. I mean, all the oil is denominated in dollars, and all transactions have to be made in dollars. So if you want to buy oil in quantity from the London or New York exchanges, you've got to have dollars to do it.
Exactly. So the situation lies where if you have a global trading situation, you're always going to have variations and differences in currency. Okay.
Right.
But if you're trading in a zone, think of it like the European zone or the North American zone or the Asian zone, you have to balance out those particular zones with a balanced currency in order for trade to, and especially labor. Now, this is the prime suspect here. The labor would be able to flow through all three countries without being abated. And the whole idea here is that the Americans have, and the Canadians have, to a certain extent, a minimum wage. Well, Mexico does not. And if you remember a few years ago, they had the right to work law passed in a few states. The right to work. So you could work, but there would be no minimum wage. You would virtually bid your job. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And would go to like the lowest common bidder. And that's how many states are still run today, where they are bidding even the lowest ranked work. And this is the reason why, in many cases, we have illegals, immigrants coming across our borders, because they can bid a day labor job way below minimum wage. You see what I'm saying?
Right. And
okay.
Now, the governor of the Bank of Canada, and we talked about this on Friday, the governor of the Bank of Canada, David Dodge, spoke to a group in Chicago back in May. This was reported worldwide by Reuters. And he said that he foresaw the coming of a regional currency like the Amero, based on the euro. They didn't call it the Amero, but he said, modeled on the euro. But first, in order to really make that happen, we needed to break down the barriers to the flow of labor across national borders. This seems to me, this would just make it easier to do what you're describing, drive down the price of labor.
Exactly. Once you drive down the price of labor, then what you have is a bidding war among, it's the race to the bottom. It is the race to the bottom. Who can do the same job for the least amount of money in order to survive? Now, that would come through several different aspects. And I know people right now who are in graphic design and advertising. I know people right now who are in entertainment. And they virtually are told what the project is worth. A company says, I have an advertising scheme. I only have $20,000. No more. Boom. You've got to give me X amount of time, labor, and materials for $20,000. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You can always have a company come in and say, I can do that for $12,000. Now, as a graphic designer, you know you're not going to be able to pay your bills, other service companies, because they can always raise their rates.
Mm-hmm.
But you are caught, labor is caught in a bidding war to the bottom, to race to the bottom. Now, what we've got, as we're racing ourselves to the bottom in labor, we've got an inflationary rate on our currency because they have just printed all the currency that they could ever possibly print. And even when they couldn't print it fast enough, they just went to computers and they just kept giving it away. And when we went to war with Iraq and Afghanistan, we borrowed $67 billion from, now this is borrowed money, from China in order to go to war in the Middle East. You see what I'm saying? Then we turn around and borrow.
Essentially the Chinese by buying up U.S. treasuries, which is how we finance the debt.
Exactly.
People don't realize this, but we're essentially fighting the war on terror with Chinese money.
Exactly. Bingo. And the and so they buy our currency, then they buy treasury bonds backed in gold. So if we forfeit, they take our gold, our bullion right out of Fort Knox, or wherever it's at these days, and they it was the World Trade Center. Now it could be back at Fort Knox. But anyway, they would pull it right out of our banks. That would be their legal right by the banking system. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is in the last four years, now Alan Greenspan says he was not at fault of any of this, and neither was his predecessor or the person that follows him, that it was virtually the president of the United States who did not veto an expanding budget bill. So it was like a runaway government. You know, you just throw in extra money, you just create extra money to keep the government rolling, whether you have it or not, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And so Alan Greenspan says, well, it was not my fault. I advised the president, you know, that six times we should go to a gold standard to shore up the overprinting of our money. And he says, you know, the president could have always vetoed any of that information, vetoed any of the extra spending bills that were put in by Congress, but he didn't, because he was going to be the compassionate conservative giving out money for Republican philosophies and views, which in turn drove up our national debt to trillions of dollars. That in just a few years, which Congress has talked about, the interest on our national debt plus the interest to maintain printing our money will cost so much we will not be able to print enough money, physical dollars, to pay it all back. You see what I'm saying? And you would say that's impossible, but you have to realize that our money is printed by a company called the Federal Reserve, and they manufacture a product, and they charge more than what that product is worth in order for them to stay in business. And they, when they can no longer make a profit off that currency, they're going to tell our government, period, the end, you're out of business. Either you file for bankruptcy because you can no longer afford our services, because we're not going to take less for our jobs. And they will tell the government, we're going to change your currency, because why? You have just allowed us to print so much, it's run away, and now a loaf of bread is $10, and a gallon of gas is $10, and a gallon of milk is $10, and it's now about, it's 5 pesos to the dollar, and it takes $2 to buy a Canadian dollar, and now it's the Three Stooges lined up, and all we have to do to correct this problem is change the currency.
Well, now, it strikes me that the Federal Reserve's got to make money other than just through the actual physical printing of money. They actually are loaning the United States the currency, in effect.
That is correct.
And they are making money off of the interest generated by the federal debt. I wondered, when it was announced during the Clinton administration that we had balanced our budget and that we were actually running a surplus, which it turns out was just a trick of accounting, using accounting procedures that have been outlawed by the federal government for corporations. If they used what are called generally accepted accounting principles, or GAAP, we still were running a deficit during the Clinton years, but that's a whole other story. But when it was announced, anyway, I was curious to see how long that would happen, because the Federal Reserve, and you called it a company, which is very astute, because the Federal Reserve is a private concern. It is not a division of the federal government. It's quasi-governmental, in that the president gets to appoint the chairman, but it is, in fact, a private firm owned by private investors who profit from the federal deficit profit from financing federal expenditures. And sure enough, within just a couple of years, the so-called conservative George W. Bush started racking up huge deficits as he expanded the scope of the government faster than any administration since FDR. The question, though, then is why would these investors deliberately allow the United States government to use its resources to spend itself into bankruptcy, basically? What do those investors behind the Federal Reserve and their what do those investors get out of a financial meltdown of the United States?
They get everything that the United States has. They get their collateral. Okay. And that's the key. The United States has to balance its books some way. So they have to reevaluate their land. They have to reevaluate their natural resources on a national scale in order for this to happen. When they do this, this is when you see land where farmers a few years ago, when I was a lot younger, land was $100 an acre. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that wasn't very long ago. Now it's $1,000, $2,000 an acre. I've got something else. Remind me about this later on, because this is the whole thing. How they're going to make their profit is by the value of land itself and our raw materials being our collateral to maintain our currency. And this is virtually what President Bush has done. And on one of my shows, I said, our president has just, to balance the budget, to balance what he would say is our debt, has put every natural resource that America has on the auctioning block. And it is now for sale, you see. And so some would argue that
that took place in 1933 when Roosevelt shut down the banks and basically signed away. But yeah, again, that's a whole nother show.
Right now, how they're going to make a profit is by forcing once you force a person to borrow against his collateral beyond the point of his net value, you then just foreclose. Mm-hmm. And then that's how you profit. You've gotten all that back. But what they're going to do is get it all back in dollars, change the currency to the Amero, and then who loses? Everybody but them. Because then they can set what the Amero is going to be worth in three different nations
now
simultaneously.
Now, and this will be interesting to see how this plays out, because the United States government is the largest landowner in the country, owns the majority of the land in the western United States, and there's a lot of value in terms of oil and minerals in that land. The question then is, who benefits from having a single currency that covers three nations? Is it because they the elites that are pushing for this don't have to deal with the fluctuation in the currency value between the dollar and the peso, or the dollar and the what do the Canadians call it, the loonie? they call it the loonie because of the picture of the goose or the loon on the back. So is that the purpose here, to just make it easy?
That is the total purpose. And once that happens, it's called pirating. I call it pirating. When the bank official comes to your house with a gun and says, either you do it our way or we take everything you've got, and we can do it by force, okay, that's exactly what they're going to do. They're going to get in return the raw assets of America and Mexico and probably most of Canada all in one fell swoop. Mm-hmm. And so America cannot say, okay, well, we'll give you California, Wyoming, parts of Texas or whatever. We can't do it that way. They can't just give the bank what it's really due. So what they're going to do is just say, okay, we're out of everything. And that's where it will have a ripple effect. The Federal Reserve will say, okay, if you what you need to do is go out and collect all the bad debt, the subprime loans, the insurance and all this. Go out and collect all that debt and bring it to us. And then if that doesn't lower the federal deficit, the federal debt, then we're still going to do it anyway. And so in many cases, you'll have banks, smaller banks, just foreclosing. Mm-hmm. Just to get the land back to save their assets. And then it'll just be a ripple effect all the way through the banking industry to where you're at a point to the Federal Reserve saying, well, our stockholders want to make a profit in the next quarter just like everybody else's stockholders. So what we're going to do is now foreclose on the U.S. government or foreclose on Mexico, and they will be virtually in debt to an outsourced corporation, which they gave their power to. Mm-hmm. And that will be how they will profit. Then they can re-regulate it and say there is no minimum wage, there is no health care, there is no flat tax or whatever, and they can tax you with whatever they want, and they can give you whatever they decide you deserve for doing his particular job. And if you stand up and fight against it, they can say, well, he's just a troublemaker. He's not going along with the system, which now is owned by the entire Federal Reserve and the global banking system. And they can then decide on the price of a life or the price of a whole civilization. Because it will be based upon the profit that they can receive. That's, you know, I told Glenn Beck one time, I said that how America is going to come down is going to come down because of greed. Mm-hmm. Because the people who print our money are getting so greedy that they're doing this by design to just test the waters and whether or not they can actually get, you know, they can gamble and get three countries instead of one. And virtually that's what we were over this negotiations right now. This is where this whole thing is coming through. And I want to back this up. This would not have started, not unless China did not want Taiwan. This goes back to a trade agreement where China wanted to adopt Taiwan. Mm-hmm. The United States said, no, we will trade with you equally as we will trade with Taiwan. Okay, a few years ago, the same situation came up. China said, if you don't buy our goods as fast as we can manufacture them, for any reason, if you stop buying our goods, we want Taiwan.
And this was what prompted Nixon to open China. This is what prompted Richard Nixon to make.
Absolutely. The 1972 trade agreement that he did with China was really the crux of what NAFTA is today, what GATT is today. These are trade agreements which supersede jurisdiction. They supersede local laws. They supersede everything because now you have a country. It's like going, I said this the other day, it's like going to a restaurant and paying $1,000 for a professional plate of food. And then the chef comes out and tells you how much you're going to really get. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? The chef has got you over the barrel. He'll give you the food he thinks you deserve, but you've got to pay him his price no matter what. So China has become the chef. But China is going to get it both ways because they can always bring up the Taiwan card, and they'll play that Taiwan card until we are virtually broke. And that's exactly what's going to happen. I mean, we can see Japan. Japan suffered the same crisis several years ago where they had runaway inflation. Their employees and their corporations were desperate. Many filed bankruptcy. Many went under. Many corporations moved into China, Japanese corporations into China, just like we had moved corporations into Mexico, 90 miles south of our border. Mm-hmm. There is the largest Chrysler manufacturing plant in the world. This is the largest Ford manufacturing plant in the world, and they are virtually assembling the cars there and driving them north, and that has developed to where they need even to do more. China says, you have signed all these treaties, and now you do not have enough ports in America to unload our goods fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to now trade with Mexico. Actually, we're going to give Mexico $1 billion to increase their port warehouse structure so they can unload ships faster and get them by rail to America even faster than that.
Now, this is what Lou Dobbs and Jerome Corsi have been writing and talking about for the past year and a half or so, and they've been roundly criticized by others in the mainstream press, especially defenders of this administration, conservatives or so-called conservatives. Michael Medved in particular really went after Jerome Corsi, called him a lot of bad names. Dobbs, to his credit, I had him on my show, and he basically said, yeah, this is coming. The North American Union is coming, and it's all about profit. It's all about elites in the United States wanting to profit by lowering the cost of their goods, by getting them from China more quickly, lowering the cost of labor by using Mexican longshoremen, Mexican transportation, Mexican trucks to get them into the United States, and then redistributing them through a series of roads and railways and inland ports, one in San Antonio, one in Kansas City, just up the road from us on I-70, another in Winnipeg. There's a story now that Canadian elites are working on a similar setup to take in larger Chinese container vessels and on one of their West Coast ports north of Vancouver and then bring it into the country through a series of NAFTA superhighways, if you want to call them. There is no NAFTA superhighway. There are multiple NAFTA superhighways that are looking to facilitate goods brought in on the west coast of Mexico into the heartland of the United States. Just a reminder, we're talking to Dr. Michael Lynch. His website is para-vision.com. That's para-vision.com on PID Radio. Michael, what it comes down to for me as I analyze the pieces of this puzzle is that it's all about power and profit. Our two biggest trading partners, virtually speaking, are Mexico and Canada. As far as energy is concerned, it's Canada.
Right.
And there are a lot of elites who would like to see us more tightly knit to Canada so that we can secure those resources. Canadians who would like to do it because it gives them greater access and perhaps control over what happens inside the United States. And people who think that, well, you know, there are just too many obstacles to this happening. For instance, the state of affairs in Mexico with drug gangs and broken down infrastructure being an obstacle to integrating the three nations, which, by the way, is a concept that's being pushed and promoted by the Council on Foreign Relations, a very influential group of political thinkers who are very deeply integrated with the U.S. State Department. And the U.S. media, I should say, I should add. But the fact is, we are offering the Mexican military and police assistance in fighting the drug wars. In fact, Jerome Corsi has written that we may see U.S. soldiers deployed to Mexico for the purpose of taking down these drug rings because they're an obstacle to trade moving across the border freely. Also, Judicial Watch has uncovered documents inside the Security and Prosperity Partnership, which is a division of the U.S. Department of Commerce, that indicates a proposal that American and Canadian taxpayers should actually finance repairs to Mexico's infrastructure, roads, railway, and its electric grid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. See, you hit it on the tipping core. If Mexico has the labor and Canada is supplying America with the energy, then it's just a marriage made in heaven. The labor force, which is suspect anyway,
right,
could easily migrate north. Canada supplying all the energy to the northern edges of manufacturing or whatever, not really manufacturing, but services. And then the labor coming from Mexico. But what the other side of the coin is that if many of the Mexicans are into crime, that come into America, well, then that's even great because they'll be arrested. And in our prison systems, even today, there are prison labor. And prisoners actually manufacture goods for the U.S. military. And they have outstanding U.S. military contracts. In Indiana, Terre Haute, Indiana, there is a major federal prison there that does many of the blankets and clothing. They used to make boots for the military. They used to manufacture a lot of textiles the military would then use for other things. And there's a whole assembly plant in Terre Haute, Indiana, that actually assists the prison labor that is there to manufacture these high quality goods. Now, they are paid 12 cents or 17 cents a day to work there. So when they come out, they will have a trade and a couple of $1,000 in the bank. Okay, the average span in the federal prison there, Terre Haute, is between 5 and 15 years.
That's sort of the Chinese model of manufacturing and labor supply. Yeah,
exactly. Now we read in the paper that Toys R Us is buying these great toys for like next to nothing, and they are being mass produced by Chinese labor camps that are inside of prisons.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so it's the same type of mentality. The Chinese prison force doesn't even get paid anything, and they're manufacturing these toys that were given to our children at Christmas time.
Well, the main difference with the Chinese model is that in China, they don't bother to actually arrest, charge, and convict the prisoner before they put him to work. Sometimes they just kidnap him and throw him into a camp and start working.
This is the same thing. I was in Pennsylvania over the summer. I took a little vacation, and we went to a coal mine. Now, the coal mine is shut down at this time, but there's hundreds and hundreds of tons of coal in this coal mine that mm-hmm. is just totally untapped. The coal mine and one that was next to it offered their people script money.
Mm-hmm.
So they were virtually working for script, not federal tender, not legal tender, but just script the company was going to do. They could only trade that script in at the company store. So they were locked into a system that the company store could charge whatever they wanted, and you would just barely meet your needs from one day to the next or 1 week to the next,
right?
Because you were just locked into that system.
Well, it's a system that my Sharon's family is very familiar with. Her grandfather was a coal miner in Southeast Kentucky. I mean, the region of the country where the movie Coal Miner's Daughter was filmed, that's where they're from, and that's what they did. So, yeah. we're familiar with that.
And so what I'm saying is, you may say, oh, well, this was just a badly organized manufacturing plant of coal, and that's just so sad to see that take place at the turn of the century, 10-year-old boys working in coal sluices to, you know, get the coal out and put into larger sluices working 10 hours a day. That mentality is alive and well today and could in weeks, months, or years envelop every facet of our economy, every facet of our labor force, even to today. And I think I think this whole thing has been a test, if you want to look at it in a certain way, on how far they can actually push the American people into this type of mentality, this type of behavior, this type of accepting what we're giving, so that they would be just so lethargic and apathetic that anything, any type of change would be good. You see what I'm saying?
How big a role does the media play in keeping the American people lethargic and like disinterested in what's going on behind the scenes?
Oh, man, 120%. I went to a local channel, Channel 5, KSDK Channel 5, mm-hmm. here in town, talked with their executive program director, and she said, I've been in television for 20 years, and we are going to end up being a website with videos on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I've been in television for 10 years, and I can tell you that you can turn this around if you go out and do stories that people will want to watch. And she says, we can't do that because we're owned by a corporation that will not permit that.
Mm-hmm.
So it is our media, because of they are so afraid of ending the game, and our media can end this game tomorrow if they would just walk out and turn off their corporated chat line and hype line and get back to the real news and exposing criminals. I remember when Al Capone was a criminal. Today he's a CEO. You see what I'm saying? And that's not being reported in that light anymore.
No, and you know, the thing is, I don't know, as I look back at history, because you say get back to reporting on the news. I'm not sure that Cronkite and Murrow and the so-called muckraking reporters of days gone by, you know, the stories of the black and white film noir movies we see of the enterprising reporters taking down the gangs and things like that. I'm not sure that ever really happened. When you actually start digging into the history of the media, Michael, you see that the media has always been a voice for one side or the other. I had the pleasure to interview a guy who's written a book called The Words of War, in which he contrasted newspaper reportage of the Civil War from the New York Times on one side and the Charleston Mercury on the other, one representing the voice of the Union, the other representing the voice of the Confederacy. And you got completely different stories based on which story they wanted the public to consume. The Charleston Mercury, for example, never admitted that Lee lost Gettysburg. To the end of the war, they never admitted that Lee lost Gettysburg. And that's how we got started with the war against Spain. William Randolph Hearst basically got things started. And I don't see that it's a whole lot different today when you've got guys like Rupert Murdoch controlling the lion's share of the news that's consumed in the United States, when you've got other Defense Department contractors like General Electric owning another big chunk of the media.
I'm not saying, but what I'm saying is that now it's become an adjunct philosophy. They're more or less, okay, it's like I go to a lecture with, I go to a question and answer period with the president, they give me a data sheet, a press release,
right.
And the story is coming from the press release, not from the questions I'm going to ask the president. Because those questions, you see, even the president has people in the audience to ask him specific questions that he already has the answer for.
Right, sure, yeah.
See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So it's all loaded. It's a loaded press system. What we need to be saying, we need to be, if they want to play the same game, that's fine. But then don't go around saying that the local farmer carrying the gun or the homeschooler is the bad guy.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Because that's what they're getting into. The homeschooler is teaching their kids how to make bombs. You know, that's the next line, and that's totally false. There is no truth in the journalism. Now, they can hype it or spin it, however it makes to sell papers. That's what Hearst was all about. Mm-hmm. But the idea was that there has to be a line of credibility of saying, I'm not going to impeach or intimidate or belittle an opposing opponent before, impeach him before he has a chance to speak. And that's the whole idea. You know, this is now a system to where if I don't like the jihad, they are the devil incarnate. Well, if Hugo Chavez doesn't like our president and he goes to the UN and says the devil was standing right here the other day, meaning our president, that's his right to virtually say that. But it's not to be have this vindictive, vicious attitude on who is the good and who's bad and determine that in some type of philosophical way that the press is giving that out to the public, you see.
Well, getting back around to where we started here with the North American Union and the Amero, I think, you know, some of these rabbit trails are really good to kind of amplify what we're talking about.
I think
we can tie these points together.
Yeah.
Because as I mentioned earlier, guys like Lou Dobbs and Jerome Corsi are being roundly ridiculed by the so-called mainstream media as wild-eyed conspiracy theorists. And there are a few lone voices out there, like Glenn Beck is starting to, you know, talk about the North American Union and how he sees that there is a this is the only way to make sense out of the failure of this administration or any administration to close down the southern border, is if you view it like maybe they don't want to close down the border. Well, why wouldn't they want to close down the border? Well, maybe if they're going to do this, then this makes sense. Then the open border makes sense. He's beginning to follow along that path. But when you still hear the real influential guys like Limbaugh, like Hannity, guys who, incidentally, rabbit trail here, alert, I've mentioned this a couple times on the show when I just can't take it anymore on the radio show. When Hannity and Limbaugh rail against the mainstream media, you have to remember this. Limbaugh has about 13 million listeners a week. Hannity has almost 12.5 million listeners a week. The New York Times circulation is about 1.6 million. Okay, the main news anchors on NBC, ABC, CBS have between 7.5 and 9 million viewers. So when Hannity and Limbaugh talk about the mainstream media, they are the mainstream media. So don't.
That is correct.
Right. So when they start ridiculing guys like Lou Dobbs or Jerome Corsi or you or me or Glenn Beck for being wild-eyed conspiracy nuts for talking about this behind-the-scenes push by elites in the United States to do what they've done in Europe and break down national sovereignty, you got to remember that there's something else going on here. And I've got to believe. And I can say this now because I'm not saying it on the airwaves on the radio station, right, that the reason that guys like Limbaugh and Hannity are on over 500 radio stations each is because they play ball. That's sure. why they get invited to the White House to talk to the president, because they play ball. And I think that is what it comes back to when we're talking about the press and the media and the willingness of the media to report press releases instead of actually digging and saying, well, if that's true, Mr. President, why do we have this quarter-mile-wide highway that's being built in Texas with foreign money? Why are we selling off infrastructure to foreign countries? Why are we allowing Mexican trucks to ride? You know, why? And those questions aren't being asked by enough people in the media, right, a few here and there. And but not enough. And until that happens, most Americans, sadly, will sit back and say, okay, what's, you know, who's playing football on Monday night, or you know, who's left on American Idol?
What a lot of people don't understand is that, you know, they will go virtually up, and as you know, if anyone studies the Book of Revelations in the Bible, pick it up. It's a fascinating read. The whole idea is that to get on some of these federal health plans and federal, just to get your Social Security and retirement, in the near future, you will need a biochip with all of your data on it. And this is a fact. They have mass produced an insertable chip into everyone.
Oh, believe and me, you're preaching to the choir here.
and if you want to get on Hillary Clinton, who is a globalist, if you want to get on her health plan, which I agree we need some type of health care, you will probably be given a chip. If you are on welfare and your kids need a certain amount of health care or assistance, they will have a chip. It is going to be that bad, and it will not dawn on many people until they are lined up, and it's not going to be a card anymore. It's not mm-hmm. going to be a form of ID. It will be injected into their arm, mm-hmm. and then they'll say, oh, my God, why didn't we stop it? Why? You know, the Jews were lined up in concentration camps, and they were being tattooed with a number on their arm, mm-hmm. okay? And then they said, how can this happen? We fought in World War I. We lived in the greatest democracy in the world. How could this ever have happened? And it's easy when the general public is misinformed or misled by their government and also by their media. Anything, Derek, can happen. And that's why we have to ask the important questions, and we have to get the right answers from all this. And when these people see this, when they see this chip being injected into their children's arms, and if they don't do something about it at that time, then there's no turning back. We will be what we fought in the 60s. We will be communists. Mm-hmm. We will be one. Not socialist, we would be a communist party, one group party, no different than the Chinese, no different than the Russians. We will be all of that, not unless we can fundamentally find a way to just say, enough is enough. You've taken away everything that made us human, that gave us the rights that humans have, hold dear. They have taken all that away, and now we're left to be able to say, what? We're going to turn the machine off again? Now, you know, that's how far we've gotten, and it scares me. It really does scare me.
Well, now, since you opened that can of worms, we'll let the conversation go there. As I mentioned, Christians understand the significance of the one-world government in terms of end-times prophecies, and I don't believe, ultimately, we're going to stop it. I think what we're seeing is a recreation of the one-world government that existed under Nimrod in the Old Testament. And we saw what God did, you know, when he came down to the Tower of Babel and said, this isn't going to stand. And that'll be, I echoed in the Second Coming. That's how I interpret the Book of Revelation, but, you know, your mileage may vary. I don't know that we're going to stop it. The comfort that comes from being a believer, of course, is knowing that God is ultimately in control. So while it's not going to be a fun ride, we know that the good guys ultimately win. Now, I know you hold some different views, Michael, and I'm just curious about that. Where do you see this going? And I've heard you talk before about the significance of the years 2010 and, of course, 2012 with the right. Mayan prophecies and the end of the astral cycle and all of that. Just, we got maybe 10 minutes or so here. Let's go in that direction a little bit. Where do you see events playing out over the next 5 years?
It will go, Derek. We will, in the next year, about this time, Mexico will change its currency to the Amero because of its trade negotiations with China and also a need to support its currency, which at that time, the Amero will then be more than the American dollar. The American dollar will be still, you know, falling over the next year or so. And if we don't fall into mass bankruptcies or whatever, we will then follow suit because the Mexican peso or the Mexican Amero, the Amero currency, will outweigh the Canadian and the dollar. So what we'll do is say, let's just join the game. So we'll convert our currency to that. Now, once all that's done and Canada goes on probably half and half for a very long time, we're going to be right on to the brink of the labor situation and the money situation. And this is where, if I know a lot of people don't believe this, but this is really what's going to happen, is that by 2010 we have farmers in America unable to even plant or grow crops to sustain even the most humblest of livings. They have been going into debt for a very long time. We've had no sympathetic government to even assist them in this endeavor. They have, their farms have gotten smaller and smaller, and they will not be able to function. Now, to be a farmer in the future or right about now, all your cattle have to have a biometric chip injected into it. Pigs, chickens, beef cattle all have to have it and will be mandatory. Now it's voluntary. It will soon be mandatory for whatever product you are grazing or selling for your income. That is to do quality control inventory by flying over just a region of the state. They will know how many cows, chickens, and pigs are being produced on a daily basis. They will then go to the point where they will actually probably form a rebellion type obstacles by 2010. And by 2010 through 2012, we will be looking at pockets or regions to where we have farmer rebellions, we have internal strife and strikes, and the whole idea is that they will still beat the drum on the war on terror, and the war on terror has got them in so far that now it's hard to get them out again. And the sunset laws and the U.S. Patriot Act and a few other things, they have extended those to the end of the Bush presidency. They may extend them a little bit further, but these things are just part and parcel of what everyone will start rebelling against. And it's not only going to be farmers, it'll be college students with $100,000 debts. It'll be many corporations and businesses that have been able to skirt certain loopholes in order to maintain a profit. Now won't be able to. They'll have to pay everything. You'll have people not paying taxes. They will not pay their taxes on time or at any time. There is just going to be internal strife for the next few years. And the next president will try to keep it all together, will do the best, you know, that they possibly can. But in the end run, by the end of the next administration, we will see civil war. It'll just be civil war. That's how chaotic it will be.
You think it's going to get that bad?
Yeah, because everyone still owns a gun. They still take pride in being an American, and the changing of the currency won't deter them. It'll just make them worse. So it's like a hornet of bees. If you handle a few of them, they're okay. But if you hit the beehive all at once, they're going to enrage everybody. So a lot of these Rex 84 camps and things like this, which we're kind of beating around the bush that they will probably intern the most vocal people first. And those people will be silenced, and then as those people are being silenced, it'll just become the gulag, the prison labor camps we've seen so many times. And they do not want any opposition. Their weakness is that they do not want opposition. They want this to go. They have paid the people off to make sure that this works. This is governors of states, mayors of cities. They've either eminent domain or appropriated the land under certain terms of either banking or buying out. And they have every contingency ready to go at this time. It's just the mass consciousness has not woken up to the fact that now we're entrapped, and you will not be able to leave your own country to go to another country unless you virtually sneak out. I went down to the post office the other day to buy a visa. Now is like $200 and some odd. I heard it's going up to $400 to buy a visa to leave your own country. There are a myriad of small, unique details that are being put into place that not every single person has information on or even knows where to look. And I think it is going to be so bad that within, 6 years by now, from now, at least six years, you will be given a chip. It will be injected into you. And by 2010, I think that's probably the whole thing that blows it off, is by 2010 when the preachers actually stand up and say, this is the mark of the beast. If you get one, you're in the beast system. If you don't get one, you'll remain a Christian, you know. And then that's the crux. You will actually have Christians taking the very word of the Bible so seriously that it becomes a newfound religion. And I hate to say this, I have talked to a lot of people saying that if you don't get the chip, if you don't get the federal ID, you will be a second citizen and they will treat you as such. And that line comes out of Rome, where if you were a Christian, you were a second citizen. Mm-hmm. You had to be a Roman citizen to be treated as a first citizen. And so what is happening in America today, as political parties go back and forth, they will soon attack the Christian party, the Christian religion, as saying that it's a detriment to our freedoms. The Christian religion is a detriment to our way of life, and because they are not getting their chips, they are not getting into the system, they're not getting on board, so they must be terrorists, they must be homeschooled people, they must read their own Bible and interpret that, so they must be terrorists by every sense of the word.
Well, we've seen,
you know, that's the idea.
Yeah, we've even seen hints of that with the primer that was put out, the brief that was put out by the FBI before 2000, hinting that there would be an uprising by certain radical Christian groups trying to jumpstart the apocalypse, which is ridiculous on its face, because any serious Christian who has read the book of Revelation knows it's not going to happen when any man or a group of men tries to get it to happen. It's coming on its own timetable. Right. In fact, when Jesus said no man knows the day or the hour, he meant everyone, including him while he was in his in human form.
Right.
So it was kind of laughable, but it gives you an insight into the way certain elites think about Christians and the threat that they somehow pose to this order that they're trying to establish over the government. I'm not sure I see it as quite as bleak as you, Michael, but it's again, I do see that the trends are moving in that direction.
Yeah.
I have no idea when it's going to happen.
Yeah.
I know that a lot of people look at the year 2012 because of the astronomical portents.
Right.
And looking back in history, we see there's plenty of evidence for major changes taking place at about the time that the eon it comes to an end. As we see the sun rising from the mouth of the Ouroboros on December 12th, 2012. You know, that may be the end of all things, the start of a whole new era, start of a new world. We don't know. I'm not losing any sleep over it. Not because I don't care. Not because I'm not watching it. But again,
right.
because I've got some security in who's ultimately in control.
Sure, absolutely. But no, I mean, I agree. We can only take this, you know, certain seriously. But I'm saying that in my lifetime, mm-hmm. I will have seen it go from a total free citizen of America, totally free, to totally indentured servitude for every generation after that until about 2012. If something does not happen, and I think that's the whole key. I mean, it's not the end of the world. I mean, life continues after that. But I'm just saying that there will be a moment in time to where we the people need to wake up and say, you know, like, just like you said, who is ultimately in control and why? Why have we allowed this to go so far and taken away the dignity of the human individual? And that's the whole key. That's really what I'm seeing as the mass consciousness.
Well, going back to ancient Rome, it's bread and circuses. We're too distracted by what's happening on television to really pay attention to what's going on in the world around us. And mm-hmm. we've allowed the control of the government, of the people, by the people, and for the people to slip into hands, you know, the hands of those who are willing to really get their hands dirty in trying to assert control over over all of us. Again, we just have a minute or two and want to kind of recap or just kind of bring it back home again. The baby steps that we see toward this ultimate control exercised by a one world government, we see in the steps that are being taken behind the scenes quietly through groups like the Security and Prosperity Partnership or initiatives like the Security and Prosperity Partnership. To break down the national borders, because sovereignty, national sovereignty and independent liberty are obstacles that they'll need to overcome in order to impose this one world government. Dr. Michael Lynch's his website is paravision.com. That's para-vision.com. You see a picture of him on the page there, smiling with Glenn Beck on the cover. You become a semi-regular on Glenn's show, I take it.
Once in a while, when he comes across something that just doesn't add up, I always somehow have already got the key to it several months earlier. I think Glenn is a very complex person, mm-hmm. but again, he's listening. And for a person in his media genre to listen to the little people at the bottom is very good, because like what you said, Rush Limbaugh and Hannity, they are the mainstream, and their combined salaries, what Rush Limbaugh makes and what Hannity makes, their combined salaries is more than what some small towns in Missouri or Indiana actually make in per capita per year.
I was going to say probably larger, you know, than the gross domestic product of half the countries in Africa, but that's
yeah, exactly, and that's not that's sad to a certain extent, because the people they're preaching to are the same people whom should be saying, well, Rush, where do you make your money? Mm-hmm. And why are you being paid the portions that you are, that are so outrageously disproportionate to really the truth that should be out there? And I don't call myself conspiracy a person. I see things coming into being as fact. And I always tell Glenn once in a while, I say, well, it will be a fact after the fact. So I'm just saying, it's not a conspiracy if it happened, mm-hmm. you see. So JFK did not die of a conspiracy. He died, he was murdered, okay? The plan to murder him was the conspiracy. You see right. what I'm saying? That's the whole idea.
Yep, so. and to cap it off, and it's not paranoia if they really are out to get you. Dr. Michael Lynch, great. Thanks for joining us on PID Radio.
Thank you, Derek.
And be back next week. Sharon will be here with us. We thank you for listening. Of course, the show notes will be at PIDradio.com, as well as the contact information. Again, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
demand.
This is PID Radio.